Investable Universe is about thematic topics in real assets investing. This is what we mean by the global market of things: real estate, infrastructure, land, energy, and other commodities that have historically been viewed as boring old income investments. But take a look at the shifts underway in these asset classes, from industry disruptors to new investors to emerging markets to geopolitics, and you'll find these assets are very interesting. We'll talk about private equity, venture capital, corporate VC, sovereign wealth funds, listed markets, crazy startups, some old guard investment firms, some maverick entrepreneurs, and some paradigm-shifting technologies. One thing is certain, no corner of the global market of things will be left untouched by the changes happening right now, and that's what we talk about on this podcast. When we talk about the emerging Arctic economy, the focus is often on extractable natural resources and how those are protected or exploited or sustainably harvested. But what might be the ultimate resource, what has elsewhere been called, and not without good reason, the new oil, is data, the fuel of machine learning and artificial intelligence. My guest this week is a pioneering innovator of that powerful resource. Leslie Canavera is the CEO of Polarctic, which develops artificial intelligence and machine learning models for companies working in the Arctic region. Specifically, the company has developed a customizable neural network algorithm called IceCubed, based on historical data and trends that can forecast up to a year the future ice breakup and ice freeze patterns in the Arctic. Leslie Canavera is a United States Air Force veteran who served as a commissioned officer. Polarctic is a member of the Arctic Economic Council, and Leslie currently leads the Council's Blue Economy Working Group and serves on the Maritime Working Group and the Infrastructure and Investments Working Group. Leslie, thank you for joining Investable Universe today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, this is going to be an amazing topic. I think artificial intelligence and machine learning applications in the Arctic. So, like, this is amazing. What in your view, to help us understand, what is the most impactful data application of AI in the region as you see it?
So, the number one application that we feel is climate change. Mm-hmm. And so, really, when you think about that, all natural systems are nonlinear. Mm-hmm. So, if you push them a certain amount, they move more or less that amount. And the Arctic is being pushed really hard by climate change right now. Mm-hmm. And AI is designed to estimate that nonlinear effect. And that will help us really understand how much climate change will push the Arctic in new ways. And these changes take a lot of different forms. So that could be coastline erosion, nearshore bathymetry, sea ice, and food security. And one of the ways that we kind of joke about this is the Arctic is between a rock and a hard place, mm-hmm. in that it's an uncharted rock at 4.1% of the U.S. Arctic is charted to navigational standards. And then the sea ice and mm-hmm. coming in and really be able to understand that spatial temporal change that we're seeing in the sea ice as we see in the system.
So for Polarctic, who are your clients primarily? Are you primarily working with shipping companies? Are there government agencies that you work with?
Yeah, so currently we've been working with shipping companies and then communities as well. Mm-hmm. And so the shipping companies, obviously from the ice cube and the sea ice forecasting and being able to understand the when and where the sea ice is going to be, but then the communities as well. And so that nearshore bathymetry, we like to call it finding zero, mm-hmm. of where the shoreline meets the ocean. And that can change a lot, again, with coastal erosion. And then you have all these storms that are coming in and kind of changing that. And that becomes also really important for doing habitat mapping, mm-hmm. as the nearshore really is that nursery for a lot of the fish and invertebrates that you see in the Arctic that kind of fill that food chain. And so that really becomes this understanding that, and then the infrastructure that really follows that. And so that would be mm-hmm. the follow-on of the government and being mm-hmm. able to understand, you know, like the infrastructure, the search and rescue, mm-hmm. all of those kind of aspects of it.
Okay, but let's maybe talk about the overall market size for Arctic data applications. I mean, you sort of talk about communities and shipping companies that are, you know, that are dealing with, you know, with more immediacy, maybe have a more immediate need for climate change data. But where do you see, what beyond just, you know, shippers and you know, environmental surveyors, what's the potential market like for a data product that focuses on Arctic data points?
So one of the best kind of things that we found from a total market size was in 2016, when the global financial firm Guggenheim projected there were about 900 projects or an estimated $1 trillion in infrastructure investments over the next 15 years. Mm-hmm. And they saw the Arctic as such an investment that they even joined the Arctic Invest Economic Council to be able to get that network and be able to get into that. And so I think it's kind of interesting from the blue economy side, which is really what we're focused on from an oceanographic perspective and kind of looking at it more in the different kind of sectors. You have the insurance for shipping, for being able to understand routes and planning, the adventure tourism that you start to see now really taking off as people are seeing that sea ice retreating, they're pushing further and further into the Arctic, into the north. And you see a lot of more companies and you see cruise lines that are starting to kind of get into that. And so making sure that they're safe from the passengers, from the ecological side, all of those, precision fishing, which is a new analytics for looking at being able to identify the fish, the biomass, do it sustainably, reduce bycatch, reduce emissions by being able to go exactly where you know the fish are going to be based on the different factors. And then you can look at like the crabbers as well, and they like to fish the ice edge. And so being able to, again, understand where and when that's going to be. And that really reduces lost gear and the plastic waste that we see in the ocean. And so being able to make sure that they don't lose that gear and create that. And then, like we said, like the habitat mapping, the commercial values of those different habitats and being able to understand how that change is impacting the fish, the different invertebrates, the circulation models, and being able to identify, again, that nearshore bathymetry or just the bathymetry in general to be able to understand that. Because a lot of it's been covered with ice. And so some of it just hasn't even been surveyed. And then mariculture. So that's a big new kind of emerging group. And they're looking at kelp farming and the benefits that really reduce ocean acidification. It creates diversification for the different fishing communities. So as these fish stocks potentially dwindle or there's reduction in the amount that they're allowed to get, they can diversify that by essentially growing the kelp. And it's in the off season for fishing and it has great environmental benefits. And then again, like what I talked about from the coastal erosion perspective, the infrastructure and making sure that you're building that in a way that it will withstand these new storms, the lack of sea ice, the permafrost melting.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of the information, or should I say the habitat that you were studying, has been under ice since time immemorial. Now, the way that this, so when you want to study this from an AI perspective, and I think when you, when you're talking about AI applications, you think of having access to large historical data sets. So when you're dealing with a, with an environment that has not been accessible until very recently, is harvesting enough historical data a challenge? Let's say a special kind of challenge in the Arctic, and how do you work around that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a big challenge because of the harsh Arctic environment and being able to get those in situ kind of measurements of like actually in the ocean, like being able to get like a buoy out there that can withstand the pressure of the sea ice or being frozen and thawed and just the different kind of environmental conditions. It really does challenge those in situ. But then you have longer satellite records for different sea ice and applications. And so those from NOAA, from the EU Sentinel missions, those actually provide a lot of data. And you have to get really creative in how you use the data that you do have. And so one of the examples that I love to give is one of the things that we did for our CENA model, which is the coastline evolution and nearshore approximation. And we built these different scientific models built based on, so like one of them is for satellite drive bathymetry. One of them is for wave inversion, where you take the wave and the height of the wave, and you're able to understand the depth based on how the wave moves. Well, being able to get information on how the wave moves is actually very challenging. Mm-hmm. And we were able to derive that from static imagery. If you look at the Sentinel data in their optical imagery, there is a time delay between the red, blue, and green bands. And if you take that time delay, you can actually get how fast the wave is moving from the static imagery to be able to calculate the velocity, the height, and then be able to calculate the depth. And wow. So you can then use that in a very turbid area, like in Alaska, where the water is very silty, to be able to get the depth from remote sensing. Wow. So you have to get creative.
So you mentioned the technological challenges and the environmental challenges of collecting data in the Arctic, but do you encounter any kind of regulatory or government challenges when you're collecting data in the Arctic? Maybe even geopolitical challenges. I mean, it's an area where entities or countries or communities lock horns, or maybe it's an opportunity to work together. I don't know. What's been your experience?
So I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and my experience in the Arctic community is that it was really friendly, welcoming, and inclusive. And so we see a lot of these different groups and indigenous organizations, businesses, governments really working together because we have similar goals to achieve. And we have been able to find that. But you do have some places where, like Canada, you have strict permitting requirements to be able to do the field work to make sure that you're not disturbing the animals as they're doing migratory behaviors or really interrupting the subsistence food security that the indigenous populations are being conducting there, to make sure that the field research is really done responsibly. And then additionally, you have the Central Arctic Ocean commercial fishing ban, and that really went into effect recently. And that's really to understand the Arctic ecosystem and to identify the baseline to be able to future research and understand kind of where these businesses are going and what they're doing and the impact that they could have.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about Polarctic's sort of business model. Do you operate as a subscription service? Is it like a sort of software as a service model?
So we're pretty young. Mm-hmm. We started in late 2018, and we've really been doing the lean startup canvas kind of approach to understanding the business, the environment, and the customers because of the change that the Arctic is really experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so Polarctic's business model has been really to provide the artificial intelligence results and consulting services as custom generated reports and information. Mm-hmm. But really where we'd like to go is like what you said, with the artificial intelligence really as a service, right, and being able to provide that to the different groups as information and make our model more accessible to the people who really need that information. Mm-hmm. So if that were to be shippers, to be able to understand the different ice conditions for the polar code requirements for their ship, or the crabbers, again, to understand the ice edge and where that's going to be in the near future so they won't lose gear, and really be able to make that accessible in kind of a dashboard interactive format.
Yeah. So what kinds of hardware applications do you work with? Does your software based model work with in order to sort of crunch data? Do you use rely on like specific satellite application or satellite hardware? Do you need LIDAR sensors? Does your data communicate with like smart ports, or like how does it, what's the hardware angle to this emerging field that you're operating in?
So I think, As a data company, I mean, our answer is always yes, more data, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's just like our default. Mm-hmm. And we take a whole bunch of different data sources from these different hardwares, from these remote sensing, mm-hmm. And are able to incorporate that together. And so we have a couple examples of like working with open source data collected from remote sensing to be able to build like the foundation of the model, and then to layer on proprietary company data, mm-hmm. gathered maybe from a radar of a ship or ground penetrating radar to be able to understand the thickness of the ice, and take that and incorporate those together to make a more holistic picture. So you get kind of the big and the micro and are able to train on that from a from an AI perspective.
So you mentioned that the company Polarctic launched in late 2018, and you've sort of doing the lean, fast-moving startup model since that time. Who are your investors, if you can identify them?
So we haven't actually leveraged any outside investment yet. We've been doing organic growth. Mm-hmm. We did have, in 2020, we got the National Science Foundation Small Business Innovative Research Grant mm-hmm. for being able to develop our SINA model. Mm-hmm. And then other than that, we've had contracts, we've grown organically, and being able to really understand the business needs and tailoring our model mm-hmm. to fit those requirements.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned that you are born and raised in Alaska. You are a United States Air Force veteran. Now you are you're at the helm of Polarctic. Talk a little about your trajectory from Alaskan to active duty U.S. Air Force veteran, now polar Arctic entrepreneur.
It sounds like just kind of a crazy journey. And I think maybe from an outside perspective, it is. But it doesn't seem as crazy living it. Mm-hmm. So I was born and raised in Alaska. I'm Alaska native. I'm Yupik mm-hmm. From the Bristol Bay region in Alaska. Mm-hmm. I grew up there, loved airplanes, went to every air show, eventually joined the Air Force, mm-hmm. Couldn't stay away from it. In the Air Force, I did a lot with remote sensing. Mm-hmm. And so coming out of that, I went to the National Geospatial Agency and did some more there. And I was talking to my co-founder, Lauren, and I was like, you know what? A lot of this information, data, things like that, AI is really like an emerging technology that I could see really helping a lot of the people, like our family, our communities. Mm-hmm. And she was on board, and her background is a physical oceanographer. Mm-hmm. And so we were like, we have this great experience and knowledge and kind of where we came from to be able to put all of this together in a really kind of different and unique kind of way to apply it, we thought. And so we started in late 2018, like I said, and based on Lauren's connections from oceanography, we got a contract pretty quickly once we started the company with MRV, who did in-situ buoys. And we were able to take that and kind of give ourselves a little ramen budget where we were able to afford like our website and different development and R&D and talk to all these different groups. And that's really where we joined the AEC to mm-hmm. be able to kind of build that network and understand the holistic picture of the Pan-Arctic better mm-hmm. As Alaska is only a part of it. And you just have these great values and ideas and things that the rest of the community brings. And so being able to take that and bring that together and network was a great opportunity for us. And so over the past 3 years, our revenue has increased at 11x over the past 3 years. And so we've been really lucky and worked really hard to kind of grow this and network into this community.
Okay, so you mentioned the importance of the Arctic Economic Council as Polarctic began to scale and you continue to scale. Talk a little about the council, what its role is, and whether, you know, do its members speak with one voice on economic matters as they pertain to the Arctic?
Yeah, absolutely. I can talk a little bit about my perspective and what it's done for Polarctic for sure. Mm-hmm. The AEC is this great Pan-Arctic community, and they're really interested in sustainable development and this impact and being able to identify these shared goals and global responsibility. And they, like all groups, there's opinions, mm-hmm. and they're not always completely the same. In terms of how far we should push for what, but it's a great dialogue. Everyone's incredibly respectful, understands the different perspectives, compromises really well in terms of like, all right, well, this is really important to you and this needs to be done here. And you can see that collaboration on a really interesting scale. And recently the AEC just celebrated its sixth anniversary after breaking out from the Arctic Council, and has signed a couple of different agreements to work again more collaboratively with the Arctic Council to be able to, again, bring that kind of public partner, private partnerships together and really identify and move the Arctic forward in its global kind of role and economically. And part of that has been the Arctic investment protocols and those being able to take those and make really good investments. And the Infrastructure Investments Working Group, the IIWG, is currently working on a project to identify some of the best practices in the Arctic to be able to share that to increase investment and knowledge of what's going on in the Arctic. So investors feel more comfortable coming to that and kind of understanding it and investing in it. And I think that's been a real thing because like you said, at the very beginning is a lot of it's been, it's like natural gas, it's oil, but there's so much more that the Arctic has that is great from the community perspective. And so I think you'll see that here in the near future, and it'll be really great to be able to get that out and share that.
So it's interesting in your description of the Arctic Investment Protocol, and I'm wondering if you could sort of give your feedback about that, because I wonder, is the Arctic an area where maybe there's an opportunity to put some guardrails on the investment process or the investment approach that maybe that's maybe an approach that hasn't been taken in other parts of the world, where investors and private equity roll into town and they're going to throw a bunch of money around and, you know, they're not going to take no for an answer, or they'll, you know, walk, you know, maybe it hasn't been as circumspect a process as it could potentially be in the Arctic. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what it's intended to do, is to make sure that investment is responsible and that people are coming in there. I mean, the Arctic has a great track record in terms of, if you look at the investment, what's been built, you can see in some of the different mining groups and areas that it's taken really responsibly. And so to make sure that that continues, especially as you see this as, like, you know, a new opening area where there's going to be more investment, and to take that and really make sure that it's done smartly, it's done responsibly, it's like it's thought through in a really investable and sustainable way.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we like to think of, is that there was a UN report, it's Our Common Future, and it's their definition of sustainable is humanity has the ability to make development sustainable to ensure that it meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And I think that's a really important way to look at it, in terms of, like, we're going to develop this, we're going to do different things, we're going to build things, we're going to start shipping. A lot of people, when they talk about shipping in the Arctic, they think trans-Arctic shipping. But you have a lot of communities too, especially like in Alaska, that aren't connected by road or by anything to another area. So they either have to get air transportation or by sea, and to be able to fly supplies in, it's too expensive. And so you get these shallow draft barges to be able to go into these communities and bring them supplies. And so shipping in the Arctic can be many different things. It can be destination, it can be trans-Arctic, but to just shut it down completely, you're shutting off an entire group of people from supplies that they potentially need. So again, it's to look at it holistically and responsibly.
Yeah. Do you think that some of the transportation infrastructure investment in the Arctic may not just involve shipping, for example, or airports, but like roads, for example? I mean, if the area is thawing, I mean, it's what about things like road investment that we think of as like the kind of boring, cement mixer type infrastructure project?
Right. Yeah. Again, talking about Alaska, when you're looking at the permafrost too, and it's melting, the roads become a huge problem. Mm-hmm. So to be able to do a road that won't just have huge swells and upheavals as it freezes, thaws over the cycles, would be an incredible undertaking. But right, like the investment and from the road infrastructure, mm-hmm. and then also from telecommunications, right. and being able to look at like broadband. Mm-hmm. There was a project that we were looking at doing with a buoy, and we were going to have to mail thumb drives through mm-hmm. the postal service to be able to get the data, because there was no actual connection there in the Arctic. And so when you're looking at that, and then you're thinking of these communities through this distance learning that we've had mm-hmm. through COVID, like how are these communities able to understand and take that? So
what people misunderstand about the Arctic, or maybe, I mean, it's the Arctic is changing, right? I mean, so it's maybe the emerging Arctic. What do people misunderstand about the emerging Arctic?
So I think my biggest thing is that people assume the Arctic is pristine and it will remain that way and unchanged by climate change if we don't do anything. And that's just not true. The Arctic is changing. The world is changing with climate change. And we need a safe and responsible way to adapt to that change. And that's what Polaric is really looking at doing with our analytics, mm-hmm. is increasing the safety of shipping to prevent accidents. So knowing, again, the spatial temporal of when and where that sea ice is going to be, supporting kelp farms that reduce ocean acidification and give the fishermen additional income by diversifying their income streams, mm-hmm. highlighting where we can safely fish to reduce plastic waste of ghost nets, increase the biomass of the different fish stocks. And you have this, again, bigger picture of the Arctic is changing, like the people there. Like, and so that's another big thing that people have as a misconception, is they think of the Antarctic with the penguins, and you're like, and there are people that live in the Arctic, yeah. uh-huh. and you have this treaty in the Antarctic mm-hmm. for like, you know, but you can't have that in the Arctic, because again, you have these people, you have these communities, you have traditions, you have cultures mm-hmm. to be able to try to preserve as much as we can, and being able to take that. So I think that would be my biggest thing that people have, is like this snow globe effect of mm-hmm. the Arctic. And we're just going to leave it alone and pretend that it's fine. Mm-hmm.
So based on you've got a lot of experience on the ground. You've got the full dashboard of Polarctic's analytics. Describe, if you would, for our listeners, the Arctic's environmental and economic landscape in 5 to 10 years' time, best case scenario and worst case scenario.
I would say the best case scenario is that the Arctic fisheries, the kelp, the shellfish, the other mariculture is part of the solution to feeding the world mm-hmm. and really being able to take that and share it from a sustainable way. And there's no solution to saving a lot of the sea ice that's melting every year. So identifying safe ways to travel will be really important. Mm-hmm. And then preserving the indigenous cultures and traditions, and making sure that those carry on so future generations can learn those. I would say from a worst case scenario, like we talked about earlier, is that unregulated gold rush to pull as much of the resources out of the Arctic without the plan and the thought and the really like cognitive, like, all right, so how are we going to do this? How is this going to affect the other resources in the area? And how do those play together?
This is all fascinating food for thought. Do you have any big projects coming up at Polarctic that you can share with our listeners? Maybe a big venture that you may have coming down the pike that you can share? Any, what's around the corner for you?
So we have a lot of fun things that we're working on. Mm-hmm. And one of the projects that we did recently that should be coming out soon, mm-hmm. Was using our National Science Foundation, ESPR, to be able to find an uncharted sea ridge. And wow. Uh-huh. That's really a important thing, again, from those circulation models, being able to understand like how those nutrients flow, but then again, from a safety and shipping perspective, mm-hmm. and how that's going to affect, like, you know, if you have a shipping lane that you want to open up or things along those lines, and being able to have that identified for the safety so you don't have anybody run aground. So that hopefully will be coming out here soon. And then also for the, as the new chair of the Blue Economy Working Group for the Arctic Economic Council,
yes, congratulations.
We have, thank you. We're working on a value food system map for the Arctic, for the blue economy and the food systems that are there. So I think that will be really exciting. And we're going to be talking about that at the Arctic Circle, if it's not canceled with COVID.
Yeah. Well, that's exciting. So good luck with all of that. Leslie Canavera, CEO of Polarctic, bringing artificial intelligence and machine learning to sustainable development of the Arctic region. Thank you so much for speaking with us this week.
Thank you.
That's all we got for Investable Universe this week. If you liked what you heard, share the link, check out the site at investableuniverse.com, or pitch us for future episodes. The address is editor@investableuniverse.com. My name is Rebecca Darst, and you'll hear more from me next time.